Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
Welcome to another episode of The Gumbo here. Today our guest is Randy England, who is a former prosecutor, current attorney, and all-around interesting, liberty-minded guy. How you doing there, Randy?
Hey, I'm great tonight. How are you, Michael?
I'm excellent. So, where do you practice? What kind of law? And what's your whole thing? What are you about?
Well, you know, I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I can't take any credit for that, except I was a prosecutor for so long. When I quit doing that, it was about the only thing I could do where I didn't have to crack open a book. So there you go. I live here in Jefferson City, Missouri, and I just represent, whoever comes into my office that needs a criminal representation. And I don't do civil law. I don't do divorces or estates and trusts. You don't want to come to me if you need a will.
What has been your journey to liberty? Tell me what you used to be like and what happened and what you're like now.
All right. Well, I'm 60 years old, so it's been a while. And I think, up to the time I was maybe about 12 years old, I think I was, just totally thought that everything the state and the government did was absolutely wonderful. I can remember putting a tape recorder on the radio so I could listen to Lyndon Johnson talk or something. It was pretty dumb. But after that, Vietnam got started up, and by the time I had, I knew some people that were in that, I started losing my enthusiasm for it. It's kind of funny, when I was a kid, about, like maybe 12 years old or something, there were some gangster shows on TV, and there were, movies and that, and I actually had this idea when I was a kid that, maybe when I was growing up, that there would be a, that I would find out that real life was kind of like it was in these movies, and that at some point you would have to pay tribute to the gangsters. And I for a time there, I almost thought that one day, like, my dad would sit me down and say, Randy, I need to tell you about, the payoff money. And I mean, I really, thought this for a while. I thought this could really be true. This is what's happened. And then, I'm 12 years old, and then I get to be 13, 14. I start doing jobs and further up and better jobs. Dad never comes and says anything. Nobody ever comes to say, hey, you got to pay your share, And so by the time I'm, 18 years old, the idea kind of faded, like I didn't think that could ever really happen. And then eventually, as it turned out, I was right, and the thugs were there with their hand out all along, but it just took a while to figure out that it was the government. And, childhood fantasy comes true, I guess. But I think most of my adult life, though, I was more conservative with libertarian leanings, but I didn't really know what a libertarian was. I think at one time my idea was more like what a lot of people think they are. It's either somebody just wants to smoke dope and have it be legal, or a libertarian is somebody who is socially liberal but fiscally conservative. And I didn't really get it, and it didn't really appeal to me. But I remember in 1988, I saw Ron Paul running for president, Libertarian Party, and from the beginning, the first time I ever heard him talk, I liked him, but I still didn't get what libertarianism was, and it was probably only in the last 10 years that I even figured out that what I was a libertarian. So I guess it was a slow process that kind of came into focus probably relatively recently. When I figured out what I really was. And that's the short story of it.
Talk about the book that you've recently written.
Well, after I figured out that I was a libertarian, you know, you want to talk about it. I mean, you have this government out there that's doing all sorts of things they have no right to do, and you want to talk about it. Well, I'm also a Catholic. And, you know, I have a lot of friends. Of course, many of them are Catholics, and I talk to people online and that, and they say, you can't be a Catholic and be a libertarian at the same time. It's just, it's not possible.
I had a question about that. You said that, and I was like, why do they say that?
Well, there's one thing.
Do you ever encounter the thing of people believing that Jesus's talk of generosity meant that the government should steal people's money to do that generosity? Do you encounter that in the church?
Well, yeah, and I think that's what some people think. They think, well, if you're not going to have, you know, welfare to help the poor people in that, then, you know, you can't possibly be Christian. And, of course, you know, this isn't true at all. I think, you know, libertarians can be as generous or more generous than anybody. The only difference is that they have true charity. You know, when I, you know, peel $5 out and give it to some guy for lunch, and that's real charity. It's not that generous, but at least I did it voluntarily. But when the government comes and steals $20 from me, and eventually they peel off the $5 after they're cut and give it to the guy for lunch, you know, which of those is real Christian charity? You know, and I say it's the voluntary side, so there's nothing incompatible with libertarianism and charity, and, you know, helping people that are, you know, that need help. I just don't like the idea of forcing people to do it. That's just stealing. And I don't think the poor person that gets it is very grateful for what they get, you know, considering that it wasn't voluntarily given.
Why, what other reluctance from Catholics do you get about libertarianism?
Okay, well, one is that economic issue, that they don't think that, you know, that it's charitable to be a libertarian because you need to take stuff. Another thing is the issue of the pro-life issues, abortion and that. They say, well, libertarians are all pro-choice.
No, they're not. That's not true.
Well, no, they're not. You know, and I have to say, look, libertarianism is a political philosophy. You know, it's not a religion. It's more like being a statist or a communist or something like that. It's a political philosophy. And people's opinion on that subject, on the subject of whether abortion should be illegal, and by legal I mean allowed, and not considered, say, a crime against a human being, really depends mostly on whether they believe that a fetus, an unborn child, is a human being that deserves protection. And we have that argument in today's society, in a libertarian society. I know we would have that same argument. And so libertarianism doesn't solve the issue for people on either side, but it's just the same issue that we have now. There's nothing particularly for or against in libertarianism. So, you know, even the issue, you know, Catholics who are taught that abortion is wrong, there's no reason for them to think they can't be a libertarian and that it would cause them to have to be pro-choice. And they don't understand that.
What's your book called and where can people get it?
Okay, the book is called Free is Beautiful, Why Catholics Should Be Libertarian is the subtitle. And it's available at Amazon. You can get the Kindle version or you can get the paperback. And if you want any other ones, you can go to there's an online ebook store called smashwords.com. And Smashwords, you can get any electronic format there, including for a Nook or a Kindle or, you know, just about any electronic format you want. So you can get it in any of those places. And, you know, I recommend it to anyone who is either a Catholic who thinks they can't be a libertarian or wants to know that it's okay that they could be, in fact, that they should be. And also for any, you know, even if you aren't a Catholic, if you're an atheist who thinks that the Christians, and in this case particularly, you know, Catholics, are an enemy of liberty, you could see this from this book, that not only are they not an enemy of liberty, but there's, you got something there to work on if you know some people who need to be convinced. And I think that's important. You know, there's just way too many Christians in this country and in this world, and there's a lot of Catholics too, that if the liberty movement has to wait for those people to go away, then we're never going to get there. They need to be converted, and they can be. And that's what the book's about.
Excellent. A couple other arguments I've heard that I don't know if they're necessarily effective with Christians who resist liberty, but they certainly create some interesting conversations. One is pointing out the fact that Jesus was killed by the government with the help of soldiers and police who were just following orders for the crime of sedition.
Well, he was killed by the government. And, you know, the way it shows in the gospel, it seems to be true that they feared him and feared that he could bring down their rule. And, of course, the authorities in Judea at the time, the Romans and the Jewish authorities were both had their reasons to fear him. And, it was a political murder.
And a lot of people would say, well, yeah, maybe so, but that was a government 2,000 years ago that doesn't exist anymore. But my answer is that all governments work the same way. They're just different degrees of tyranny, I think.
Well, that's for sure. And you know, they don't, Jesus hasn't been back to be crucified again, but they kill plenty of people all the time. I mean, in the 20th century, what can you say? I mean, the mass murderers of history have nothing on government. The one person in all of history I've heard that killed the most people was
Mao.
What was his name? He was a Russian who
Stalin
killed. I'm talking about a person who personally, with their own hand, and it was a Russian officer who, with the help of the KGB, killed, I think it was several thousand people over several nights. And this guy, no one has ever killed more than that. I mean, that's the biggest number, and yet governments kill. I don't know what. I hear different numbers, but at least 150, 160 million people in the 20th century. I mean, no one can compare with them. The damage that they do is just, I mean, Ted Bundy and these other serial killers.
Amateurs.
They don't have it.
Amateurs.
They're just amateurs, really, compared to government. I mean, they just can't. There's no way anyone can compare to government.
Do you think there's a place for any government? Any government that is not chosen, that's not voluntary to participate in?
Well, that, of course, is the key word, because, you know, I know that in the Catholic Church, you know, many of the documents in that, you know, talk about, you know, legitimate authority and that sort of thing, and that you have to have authority, you have to have rules, and all of that, you know, really is true. I mean, you know, you and I probably spend our whole day, you know, submitting to you know, many people's rules, you know, whether it's a family member or for me, you know, I belong to a church, and I voluntarily submit myself to those rules. And in fact, if I happen not to obey them all, and I don't, we call them sinners in our church, no one, you know, comes to kick me out. Nobody comes and tries to kidnap me or put me in a cage because I didn't do something right. I mean, I guess if I did something bad enough, long enough, maybe they might come and say, you really shouldn't be here anymore. I don't know. I've never had that happen to me or seen it.
I think that's how a lot of punishment would work in the absence of a government, is just ostracizing people, you know, that no one would trade with you, and you'd starve to death or have to go somewhere else and be good.
As much as possible, you would hope that ostracism would be a big factor in making people to behave, although there's no way that that's going to work completely. Like when you get to a situation, there are people, and of course, you know, like I said, I was a prosecutor for a long time, and now a criminal defense attorney. There are people that just won't work with. I mean, they're out there, and they will kill someone, and they will kill another person, and they're murderers. And you have to somehow separate them from society, or you know, if it's your job to protect society, whatever that is, whether it's your family you're protecting, or maybe you belong to a security company, you know, these people have got to be removed in some way or another. And you know, there's been places where, rather than execute people, the ostracism is at a higher level. Like they get kicked out, banished, they get sent to Australia, or they get sent to Georgia, or you know, back in the real old days. And but you cannot tolerate them in your society, or in our modern society. You know, we execute people, or if we don't execute them, we throw them in prison, and if they're bad enough, they die in prison eventually. I don't know how you can possibly maintain a society without having some people that have to have that ultimate removal by force. But of course, that would never happen except unless they've done something, you know, really horrible. I mean, they have to hurt other people.
I have a theory that a lot of people, some libertarians are kind of shocked by, but a lot of statists are shocked by, which is basically that people that are sociopathic to the point where they just want to destroy for fun and profit on a personal level would probably be taken out of the gene pool in a free market. You know, they would probably be killed in a robbery by a largely armed populace and would not have a very long career. You know, and there's some people who probably aren't sociopathic that do violent crimes occasionally in this world now, in this the way things are now. And I think that those people would just stop doing what they're doing and have to earn an honest living. But I think there are people who are genuinely broken machines, sociopaths, who probably would just get killed.
You know, that is probably true. And, you know, down here in Missouri, I don't know how long it's been. I bet it's been over 20 years. I think they even made a movie about a guy. They called him the Skidmore Bully, who was basically, he terrorized the whole little town that he lived in, and the authorities just did not move to take him out of circulation. And he was shooting people and beating people up, and everybody was in fear for their life. And one day, somebody just took him out right there on the main street of town, shot him, and he died right then. And apparently, lots of people knew who it was that did it, and to this day, no one has said a word. Wow. You cannot spread terror, you know, very much before someone is going to take you out, like it happened to that guy. And if people are terrified enough, no one will care. That I think it's a good object lesson to the, you know, to the police and the courts there.
I'm looking this guy up on Wikipedia. He was accused of dozens of felonies, including assault, pedophilia, rape, arson, hog and cattle rustling, and burglary.
Wow. That's a guy.
It sounds like a bad guy. Yeah. Man. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And like he died and nobody cared. Or maybe his girlfriend, his mother.
Oh, evidence indicated he was struck by bullets from at least two weapons in front of a crowd of people estimated between 30 and 46. And no one has been charged in connection with his death. I like it. I really do.
This I didn't
was
see anything.
In 1981.
Didn't see anything at all.
Yep.
Yeah. Wow. Over 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I remember what happened.
But, you know, it sounds like something in the Wild West, and it wasn't. It was something in modern times, so.
Well, yeah, but who can say? I mean, you know, you can say, well, it's a shame that it got to that point, but would it have been better if he went on terrorizing that town? I mean, you know, it's kind of like, you know, this is what happens when you don't stop people, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when I was a prosecutor, I always had that kind of in mind, like, you don't dare, you know, let people be out there, you know, being afraid, you know, that something like this is going to happen to them. You have got responsibilities. It wasn't, you know, prosecuting people, you know, for things like a murder and assault and robbery and theft and that sort of thing that made me want to quit being a prosecutor. I'd do that again tomorrow. I mean, that's bad stuff.
You'd do what again tomorrow?
I'd be a prosecutor again.
Prosecuting
not
real...
that I want to, but I wouldn't have a problem with prosecuting...
Real crimes.
Real bad guys. Yeah, real crimes, you know, but the... But the drug stuff and all of it, there's so many victimless crimes that just makes you...
But can a prosecutor in today's legal environment cannot choose what he takes to that extent, right?
Well, not really, particularly one starting out. You know, when I was due, a new prosecutor, I had to do what was given me. And I had a really good boss. You know, there were a few times when I went to the boss and said, I'm just not comfortable with this. I can't do this. And this guy, he was great. He said, okay, then I'm not going to force you to do something you don't feel like you can do, you know? And I mean, I always appreciated that, but you still get stuck with a lot of that stuff. And as I got more experience, you get into more like, you know, major case type stuff, major felonies. And I don't mean the drug stuff because that's, you know, I hate that completely now, and I don't think I ever liked it very much. And to the extent that I was involved in it, I'm not proud of it. But I didn't have to do that sort of thing as so much later on in my career. I was able to, you know, to try assaults and you know, murders and, you know, other things where people really got hurt, and I felt like I was, you know, doing a valuable service when I did it. But I don't know. I don't know what you know. We do with these guys. But you're right. They've got to be taken out of circulation somewhere. And there are ways that they could be done. That this could be done. I mean, I one thing that our system does that is I think is so wrong is the way they send felons. They get out of prison, and when they get out of prison, you know, even if they didn't do anything that was violent, they can't own a gun to defend themselves. You know, and places you lose your right to vote, you lose all kinds of rights. I mean, this idea that you paid your debt to society, what a joke that is. I mean, they don't treat you like you paid your debt to society. And in a sense, since restitution is such a minor part of our system, and most victims don't get compensated for how they're hurt, and the truth is they haven't paid their debt. If they had made their victim whole, they'd come a lot closer to paying their debt. And I think any system in a sane society and in a free society would the criminal system would be based on restitution.
Absolutely.
Most crimes, you know, you would probably have a system where you wouldn't have much use for prisons, and even the prisons that you did have would be more like. Work hotels or something, you know, where people could work off their restitution. And of course, it would be more expensive for them than it is now, because in our system, the victim is always victimized twice. You know, first the guy comes in and steals your TV, and then he gets convicted, they send him to prison, and now you lost your TV, but you also have to pay for his jail cell.
Yeah.
Well, you know, what's the point in that? I figure the guy ought to be working to pay you back for your TV. He ought to be paying you for every nickel it costs to bring him to justice, and he ought to be paying for his own room and board, and then whatever's left over he could, you know, use to have maybe a nicer room at the jail or something like that. But I think that, you know, wrongdoers should just simply dedicate, you know, their life to making whole whoever they hurt, and until that's done, they haven't got any higher priority. And then when it is done, they get out and they are accepted back. I think society would accept people back who had really made right the wrongs that they had committed, you know, by fixing the damage. There's an innate sense that society, you know, society and just the whole order of society is hurt when people are harmed. And so I think that by making a victim whole and making everything whole, I mean, you're paying for all the damage you caused in that, heals not only the victim and not only all the surrounding society, I think it has an effect on the defendant, the person who did it. And when they come back, they should be accepted back 100%, completely, with no, you know, additional punishments than that. I mean, you're out, you're back, you know, hope you learned something, but, you know, we're going to treat you like you did. I wish we could see more of that.
Yep.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
So, okay. Do you think that it's possible for an ethical person, you know, a liberty-minded person, a person who understands government aggression and force, to be a prosecutor or a police officer today?
Okay, well, important thing that you said there is that somebody who understands this, I think the answer is probably no. I think if somebody really comes to a complete understanding of this thing, and, you know, like I said, I mean, in my case, it came rather slowly. At some point, they're going to say, hey, I can't do this anymore. And, you know, that kind of, you know, happened that way to me. And I, you know, not that there weren't other helps. I came to kind of a logical jumping off point where one prosecutor was going to replace it another. And I thought, hey, this is where I get off. And I did. But most of these guys that are out there they're just like everybody else. Some of them are good at their job. Some of them aren't good. Some of them have good ethics. Some of them don't. But if they really understood the harm that they were causing, they would probably have qualms and second thoughts about doing what they're doing. At least I know that, you know, I began to have that, and now I've reached a point where I couldn't possibly do it again unless we had a different system where there were no victimless crimes. And then, of course, it becomes an honorable job again.
If you had a client who was arrested for a victimless crime and was facing some serious prison time, would you recommend that they proffer if it would help them get less time?
I never recommend. I don't like that.
Proffer meaning snitch, for anyone who doesn't know what proffer is.
Exactly. I don't like it, but I am ethically bound to take that to a prosecutor, a U.S. attorney, whichever the case may be, and tell them, you know, if the client wants to do this or that. You know, the thing is, there's plenty of people that, you know, would even be offended by telling them to do that. I don't really tell. I never tell my clients that they should do anything. I spend most of my effort with them, educating them, so that on the issue of their case, they come up to speed on what the facts of the case are, on what the law of the case is, what all the issues are, and then go a little bit further and say, okay, now, if you go to trial, here's what will probably happen. And if you take this deal, here's what will probably happen. I mean, I can do these things, you know, just from my experience, but I never will tell a client what they should do. You know, because I just feel like it's just too important. I mean, it's their life. I don't know. I just don't. There's certain things you'd like to do, and like as an attorney in court, criminal defense attorney in court, there's lots of times I have thoughts and things that I'd like to say, you know, coming from my libertarian background, that would feel real good to say that in front of the court or something like that. yeah, you know, I don't mean to be deliberately disrespectful, because I try not to do that to anybody. And most of these people that are in there doing these jobs, they don't in any way, you know, see themselves as doing anything that they shouldn't be doing. And they're honorable people who I think, if, you know, kind of came to understand the role of government and everything, would have second thoughts about what they're doing. So I don't mean to impugn most of them in that way at all, but I can't, But those things that I might say in that, I can almost never do that because I've got a client that I have to take care of, and you know, it's nice to go in. I think somebody's doing some pamphleting. I see about, you know, don't take the plea deal.
Yeah.
Have you heard of that one? Is that up in New Hampshire?
I hear about that every day.
Okay, well, I mean, that's a really neat thing, and I think that's a great thing for people that are, say, you know,
traffic tickets.
Liberty activists.
And yeah, traffic, yeah. Yeah.
Well, it could be anything, really, but it's something that, boy, a person needs to do what would do on their own. I mean, it'd be so easy for me to say, hey, stick to your guns, you know, we'll change the world, and then I wave while he goes off to jail, you know. I mean, I just can't do that. I have to look out for my client's best interest. And if a client comes to me and says, I want to fight this, we're going to go this out to the end and we're going to show them. I mean, I'm going, yeah, let's do it. But it has to come from them. I mean, I just can't, you know, and I'd still say, now, if you do this, you know, what's probably going to happen, you know, I mean, and depending on the facts of their case, you might be saying what's probably going to happen is that you're probably going to be convicted and then you're going to be sentenced to a lot more time than I could get you on a deal. And, you know, at that point, if they want to fight, hey, I want to fight, but I just can't do that. I can't push anybody in that direction. That's just wrong. And it's cheap because it's not my life on the line.
Yeah. So what are you saying is your opinion of the don't take a plea movement?
Oh, well, I think it's good for anybody who wants to do it, but they need to have their eyes open because they're probably going to, I don't think they're going to be able to take down the, you know, the court system. I think the part of the idea is that there's no way they have enough resources in the court system to try every traffic ticket, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think you can get enough people to do that, to cause the problems that are envisioned you would cause if everybody wanted a trial. So what happens is that most people don't do it, and the poor people that go in to do it end up being sacrificial lambs. And I just admire the heck out of them for doing it, and anybody that suffers like that, you know, for principle. But, that's such an individual choice that I just can't imagine, you know, me advocating that somebody else do it. I mean, I feel like the only person I have the right to push into that would be me.
There's a related, well, let me ask you this. If you were arrested for something, would you hire an attorney or would you represent yourself?
I'd hire an attorney.
There you go. That's the interesting thing that I say to people. There are people in the liberty movement who choose to represent themselves because they've read a couple pamphlets or websites for a couple hours and think they understand the legal system. And I think it's kind of magical thinking that that's going to go well for them. And I think the fact that an attorney would hire an attorney if he were facing trouble kind of says a lot about the smartness of that. You know, as someone who deals with the courts every day says they would hire an attorney even though they're an attorney. Why would you hire an attorney?
Well, because an attorney can say things that you can't. Like if you're the defendant, you can't go to the prosecutor and say, well, I did such and such or such and such and that. I mean, the prosecutor can use whatever you said against you, but your lawyer can go to the prosecutor and lay out a proposed defense to the case, you know, in a way without committing you to anything. I mean, you literally need to have the way the system is, it's broken out into pieces and your lawyer can say and do things that you can't do. Now the shoe goes on the other foot though. There are some people who are adamant, you know, that they want the jury to hear what they want to hear. I mean, what they want to tell them, or they want to say things in court that the attorney is not allowed to do. And, you know, there's certain things that if I got in there to say, I might get to say it once, and the judge would bang the gavel and call me up and say, not one more word about that, and like, say, jury nullification. And if you say it again, I'm going to hold you in contempt and throw you in jail. And, you know, if I want to do it at that point, I could maybe just kiss my law license goodbye. You know, I won't. That'll be my last case, perhaps. But if you're a defendant, you don't have to worry about, particularly in front of a jury, you can get away with saying and doing things that you just couldn't say just in front of, that the attorney couldn't say. So I guess there's some situations where you might not want to. Of course, there's the compromise position. At the very least, if somebody wanted to get in and do their own case without a lawyer, I would think that at least you would want standby counsel, somebody who could advise you on everything that you should do.
I mean, even just on procedure, and how to answer certain things and what you can say back in certain situations.
Right, and things to ask. And, when you have to prove certain things, you have to prove, exact certain elements, to make your point. Now, that would still only be somebody who was really wanting to make a almost political point with the court. Because I would say in almost every case, it's not going to help your case. It has to be a really rare situation that would be helpful to your case. It just might be helpful to your psychological condition.
Yeah, I think people who have a desire to represent themselves have often seen a lot of movies and think it's going to work like it does in the movie. You mentioned jury nullification. That was actually on my list of questions for you. That's a related type of activism to don't take a plea. I think it's a little more solid. And a lot of the same people are involved in one that's involved in the other. What is your opinion on the moral and legal ramifications of jury nullification?
Well, jury nullification, of course, you tell the jury that they have the right to judge not only the facts in the case, did the defendant do this, but they have the right to decide on the law. And even if they did it, should they be found guilty? Now, first on the jury nullification is that it is only applies in criminal cases. It doesn't apply in civil cases, because in civil cases, you don't have the government as a party. And so it would hardly be fair to favor one party over another, I suppose. Particularly, if there's the party that, they signed a contract between them and the jury could come in and rewrite the contract. I mean, that has a lot of problems with it. So jury nullification doesn't usually talk about a civil case. It talks about a criminal case, and it really only talks about one side of a criminal case. Because if you give a case to a jury at the end of the evidence, and the jury goes back and says, we know that he did it, but we just think this is dirty the way the government acted, or we think this law isn't fair in this situation, we're just going to find him not guilty. Okay, so the jury writes not guilty, and they come back, they give the verdict in the court, and at that point, the judge looks at it and goes, he reads the jury, it's not guilty. Well, at that point, something very important happens. The Constitution guarantees that you not be subject to double jeopardy. You can't be tried for the same case again. And the moment the jury says not guilty, it's over. Okay? You can't be retried. So at that point, if the jury says not guilty, no matter for legitimate or illegitimate reason, doesn't matter why, no one can question a jury as to why they vote a certain way. If they were taking a bribe or something, but that's about it. They can't do anything about it. So a jury has the innate power to nullify the law and find anybody not guilty, whether they did it or not. Now, it doesn't work the other way, because the jury can't say, we know that this guy probably didn't do it, but he's kind of a bad guy, so we're going to find him guilty anyway. Because what happens if they try to nullify in favor of the state? The case can go up on appeal. And the Court of Appeals can look at it and go, there's no evidence here that he did what they say he did, not guilty, and they throw it back out again. So the state never gets a chance to retry a not guilty verdict. They never get to appeal one, but the defendant having the right to an appeal if they're falsely found guilty makes this jury nullification only work in favor of the defendant. I think it's a great thing. I think it should be done. It's perfectly legal. It's legal everywhere.
It is legal, but with an asterisk. There's a guy now who is actually It's an 80-year-old man. I can't remember his name at the moment, but he was...
Oh, Mr. Heiklin, I think is his name.
Yeah, he's in Israel fleeing prosecution for jury tampering for handing out jury nullification pamphlets in front of a courthouse.
Yeah, I think that's just wrong. that's freedom of speech. I guess they think he's jury tampering or something like that.
Yeah.
But if you had to ask him, well, what jury he thought he was tampering
exactly.
with, the jury wouldn't know. I mean, what, you know, if you're handing out pamphlets, it's not about a
particular
case.
Jury, yeah.
What only thing that they're doing is simply informing jurors of a right that they already have and which they cannot be punished for exercising. There's nothing the government can do to you for nullifying the law in a criminal case. They can't make you go back and change it. They can't prosecute you. They can do nothing. And I think it's fair. You know, here in my state, I mean, we've got a legislature. They happen to be here in my hometown in Jefferson City. But we've got a legislature, and they make laws. And darn it, everybody has to obey these laws, even all the way, 200 miles away up in the northwest corner of the state and everything. And they make one law, and it applies to everybody in the state, all the millions of us that there are. And then they expect that to be fair every time? I mean, it's not going to happen. Even laws that are generally fair will turn out to be specifically unfair in certain cases. So doesn't it make sense that a jury up in the northwest corner of the state gets a case and goes, this isn't a bad law, and normally I'd be for it, but the way that it went down this time just isn't fair, so not guilty. And who's being harmed by that? I mean, it's in their county. It's their citizens. It's their defendant. And if they want to say, hey, we think you deserve a pass, who the hell is anybody else saying that they shouldn't get it? I don't get that.
Well, I get it. It's whenever there's a government, whether it's local, state, or national government, the government generally believes it has ownership over its citizens just by accident of birth somehow.
Yeah, well, you're saying what it is, and that's right.
Okay, so next question. Another thing that often ends up on the same bookshelf somehow as jury nullification and don't take a plea is something that I think should not be on the same shelf, but somehow ends up there somehow, is the sovereign citizen movement. I don't doubt the legitimacy of people questioning the right of governments to rule over them, but a lot of times I see people spreading and even selling books on the supposed magic words you use to get out from under a government's thumb. Do you know about that, and what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I've seen those. I saw those people in court even back, I don't know, almost 20 years ago. We had that movement happening when I was a new prosecutor, and I've seen it ever since. And it's just really, like I said, the sympathy, the idea that they somehow get that the government is illegitimate and its authority over them, is right in many cases. One of the problems that I used to have about it, though, even before I figured out that I was a libertarian, I always said, I kind of sympathize with this guy, but I'd be a lot more sympathetic if he wasn't being charged with writing a bad check.
Exactly.
Because he's stealing from somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think? You think you're going to get a pass? I mean, if you think that this government that's got you in there on this misdemeanor bad check has no right to be doing this to you, what are you saying? That nobody has the right? And if you're a sovereign citizen,
yeah,
you can steal from anybody? I mean, it's just stupid.
I think in a sovereign anarchist paradise, if you wrote a bad check, somebody would come after you for it.
Yeah, you're not going to get, you can't, in any society, you can't hurt somebody else and have them not come after you unless they're just a saint who says, oh, it's all right, forget it, I mean, if they by right, you stole from them, they have a right, to be made whole again. And the sovereign citizen thing, I mean, it just, I think it's misguided, and I've seen clients that wanted, to push like that kind of an agenda, like they don't have jurisdiction over me, you know, for these reasons and that. And, you know, I don't know what I, you know, what I can say. What I do say is that, look, I went to law school, you know, in a government-sanctioned, accredited law school, and then I went to the government and passed the bar and paid for my law license, and I have to apologize, but that's the system that I am trained to operate in, and actually it's the only system around here anyway, and that's all I can do for you. You know, while I sympathize with what you're doing, I said, we're working in this real world, and it's illegitimate as this or that government may be, that's the government that's got you in those handcuffs and is going to take you back to that jail cell and we're done talking today.
Yeah, I mean, I
need to work with that.
Exactly. I reject the legitimacy of all governments, but I think that a lot of the sovereign citizen, what I call mumbo jumbo, is about as effective and intelligent as if you were in a jail cell and pointed your hands and said, abracadabra, bars on the cell disappear. You know, it, the magic words aren't going to do that.
Yeah, reality always intervenes.
Yeah.
You know, you have to deal with the cards you got. The government may be illegitimate, but by golly, it's real.
Did you hear about, I think it was Indiana passing a law that said castle doctrine in your home extended to shooting a cop if he was entering your home illegally?
Yeah, I wonder how well that's going to hold up. I always figured that the castle doctrine would draw the line at shooting a cop. I can't understand why, because I think I just read last week some accounts of some home, you know, break-ins where people come in shouting police, police, police.
Yeah.
And of course it's not the police. They're coming there to rob you. And, you know, what are people supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? If somebody breaks in my door shouting police tonight, am I not supposed to reach down and pull out my Ruger LCR, you know?
I mean, we moved to Wyoming from Los Angeles, and it is not uncommon in Los Angeles for people to kick in people's doors and yell police and, you know, rape them, rob them, and kill them.
Yeah.
I figure this way. I don't do anything that would legally allow the police to kick in my door in the middle of the night. If the police wanted to talk, I don't break any laws. And I don't say that out of pride. It's kind of an experiment I'm doing. I'm paying all my taxes and being completely law-abiding. And so if I end up in trouble... That's what you think. I know everybody, you know, what's that book, Three Felonies a Day? You know, I don't do drugs. I don't have any illegal guns. I pay my taxes. You know, the things that liberty people are usually have their doors kicked in for. I don't do any of those things. And my experiment is kind of, I want to see how far I can extend free speech to the point where if my door ever gets kicked in, it's going to be for something I said. And I don't make any threats or anything like that. And I'm a nonviolent person, but I really push the envelope. So basically, if the police wanted to talk to me, they should knock on my door in the daytime and talk to me. They shouldn't kick in my door. And I believe that if anybody kicks in my door in the middle of the night, I'm going to assume, you know, it's gangs from Denver who are on a road trip or something and shoot.
Hey, they could stop this whole problem tomorrow. I know so many times when I had the cops come to me more times than I could possibly count, wanting a search warrant and they wanted to go in the nighttime, you know? And I resisted that at every opportunity that I could.
As a prosecutor.
Because, you know, yeah. I said, this is dangerous. It's dangerous for you. It's dangerous for them. And my position on it is that you don't do a nighttime warrant, a no-knock warrant even, which can be authorized by a judge. But in our state, you can't have a nighttime no-knock or no-knock warrant or both without the judge saying okay. Now, normally when the prosecutor asks for it, they'll get it. But I think it's so dangerous that I don't think you should get one unless they're actually going in there because human life is endangered. If someone is being harmed in that house, you know, if I mean, I had a, had them come and say, we think this teenage girl's being held in this house against her will. I'm going, go, go, you know. But if someone is not being harmed, no. And, you know, and I can remember, I don't know how many times they come to me wanting to do a search warrant for a misdemeanor marijuana, you know. I'm going, get the hell out of here, you know. I mean, even you ought to know that this is not, you know, you just don't do.
I think if I were a cop, I would... Even if I thought drugs were bad and people should be protected from them, I think I would be against the war on drugs because it endangers cops.
It does.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. That proves you're smarter than most people.
So I was looking at your law blog, which is blog.jeffcitylaw, J-E-F-F-C-I-T-Y, law.com, blog.jeffcitylaw.com.
That's a little complicated. The other URL for that is just randyengland.com.
All right. Randyengland.com. I like your law blog. I've actually looked at more law blogs than I have any reason to, just because I fall down wormholes on the internet. You seem to have a lot of information on here about staying out of trouble, which some would say would hurt your business, but it seems in this day and age that being helpful to people in business, even to the point where they don't need your business, actually increases business somehow. Do you find that to be true?
Well, I don't know if it's true, but I think it's the honest thing to do. I mean, you know, people, I get calls every week of people who call and, you know, can I help them? And, you know, I say, well, yeah, I could help you, but look, just do this and it'll be all right. You know, I mean, there's enough legitimate business out there. And I feel like I have some responsibility to, you know, somebody calls me and just needs some advice on something. I mean, I'll send them a bill or something. I help them if I can. If I can help them over the phone, I mean, that, you know, that makes me happy. I answer a lot of questions and things, you know, through my blog. Of course, I don't know a whole lot outside of, you know, the law in my state, but that's most of the people that contact me.
Let me ask you something real quick about that, too. People that contact you from out of state, I think a lot of people don't know about the jurisdiction that an attorney can handle. Like, for instance, any attorney can handle any federal case. Is that correct?
Well, you have to be a member of that federal bar. Like, I'm a member of the Western District of Missouri, you know, federal bar. It's not a big deal. I mean, you go, it's not like you have to take a new bar exam. If you're a member of the state bar, usually they'll take you right in. All you have to do is just pay them money.
Yeah. But generally, an attorney cannot practice outside of their state unless what? What are the exceptions to that?
Okay, well, the exceptions, you can, in many courts, and in federal court, I believe this is true, if you want to be involved in a case that's outside your jurisdiction, you can go to the court, and they have a motion, they call it a pro hoc vice, and I can't remember what the Latin means, but you pay a smaller fee, and you're allowed to participate in that one case. They do that in a lot of places.
It means for this, my paralegal wife just said. Pro hoc vice.
It means for this. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Couldn't remember. So much Latin. A lot of Latin. So
Yeah, there's a lot of Latin in there.
So can an attorney give legal advice to a client from a different state?
Well, the only time I would... you know, would do that is if they were asking about law that I knew about. Of course, if they were asking about Missouri law, I mean, I tell anybody what I can, but if it's something that I don't know about, I mean, I'm dangerous if I'm giving out advice on that. I try to get them to call an attorney, you know, in their area. I mean, you know, you say, look, most of these guys will talk to you for nothing on the phone, and they'll, and half the attorneys will give you a free consultation. Call one up and go see them, you know. I mean, at the end of the interview, they'll say, hey, I can help you or I can't help you, and I'll charge you this much. I mean, why not do it, you know?
The reason I ask is I think there is a lot people don't know about lawyers if they've never had to hire an attorney. What else would you say that a lot of people don't know about attorneys that's basic that they should know?
Well, don't just pick your lawyer out of the Yellow Pages.
How should people
pick? One thing that I encourage, and I guess this is maybe a little bit selfish because I think I told you I'm a criminal defense attorney and nothing else. And if I, you know, have, say, a personal injury case, I'm not going to call some guy whose listing of the cases he does runs the whole gamut of the law. I'm not going to hire a dabbler. I want somebody that does this all the time.
Except in Wyoming, because the state has such a low population that there are very few attorneys that specialize.
But I mean, they specialize to some extent. You'll still find somebody who, say, only does family law and criminal, okay, as opposed to everything. And the most important thing you want, I mean, if I was calling up an attorney, you know, say for a particular town, I would say, do you go to this court? Are you there regularly? You know, do you know what the judges there do? Do you know what the prosecutors do? You know, do you know anything? You know,
I just got corrected by my wife. She said people do specialize here. It's just that the state bar doesn't license people in one particular specialty, like in some states.
Oh, we're the same way here. You're not allowed to say that you have any kind of licensure or certification, but you're allowed to say criminal law. It's all I do. You know,
yeah.
You can do that. I mean, you're not claiming that you do it well. You're just claiming that you do it. So they don't care about that. I mean, they can look at you and decide, you know, whether you're just dabbling at it or if that's all you do.
Do you find that people have a misunderstanding about attorneys too, where they try to get attorneys to take things on contingency that there'd be nothing for the lawyer to collect on, or that they don't have a case?
Yeah, well, you know, I do have people call me. I don't do any contingency cases. It's not allowed in a criminal case, for one thing. Like if I get you off, I get a big payoff, but otherwise we can't do that. And in criminal cases, most of the time, you know, you're getting paid up front because, I mean, honestly, they're criminal cases, you know? or at least a good portion is up front, and you have to operate that way if you want to stay in business. But I do have people call me a lot, or maybe in along with their criminal case, they're saying the police mistreated me or violated my constitutional rights, and I have to tell them, you know, I don't handle those civil tort cases or 1983, you know, federal civil rights cases. You need to talk to somebody, and they'll talk to somebody and not like what they hear. And then they'll talk to somebody else and not like what they hear. And, you know, by the time they call and tell me this, I'm saying, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but I do hear you saying to me that you've talked to several people who don't want to take your case on a contingency fee basis. I said, you need to understand what they're trying to tell you. They're telling you that they don't think they can win and that they're going to be working for nothing, so thanks, but no thanks. you know, I mean, sometimes I think people should, you know, lawyers, you know, who don't want to take a case, you know, maybe you should, you hate to say to somebody, you have no case, all right, because later on, I guess, somebody could accuse you of malpractice when somebody else thought that they did have a case, so people don't want to say that. But it's kind of a shame, you know, that people can't read between the lines when lawyer after lawyer says, I'm not taking your case. You know, it's not like they're out there in business just so they can interview people, you know, and not take their case.
Yeah.
People, you know, that happens. I guess you just got to read between the lines when this is happening to you.
So let's end with talking a good long bit about the war on drugs.
Yeah.
I don't really have a question. What do you think about the war on drugs?
I just think it's sad. I think that it's a drug should, you know, they're a problem, you know, for many people. But it ought to be a social, a medical, a health problem. not a criminal problem. I just can't remember the last time I had a client who I thought, hey, this guy'd be better off in a jail cell. But I've got so many, you know, people that I know that are, you know, sitting in a jail cell, and heck, we're all, you know, practically high-fiving that they got 5 years instead of 12. You know, it just makes me sick. It really does. And it's pointless, and as a taxpayer, of course, I'm kind of outraged that I have to pay for it. I really wish it would end, and I don't just mean marijuana. I think every single controlled substance, it should be left alone, you know. And I don't use the stuff, you know, and I don't approve of anybody who would abuse any drug or alcohol. You know, I mean, if they asked my advice or if it was somebody that I cared about, I'd be trying to, you know, find a way out of it for them. But I just don't think it's a criminal matter. I don't know where we got off track on this thing.
If the war on drugs disappeared tomorrow, I think that a lot of people would be out of work, but you would not be out of work, would you?
Well, I guess I'd have some less work, but I don't care. I mean, at some point, you care about your own bread and butter, but I mean, I don't believe in, you know, that attorneys should be licensed. I don't even think the doctors should be licensed. I don't think that the FDA should be okay and or not okay in drugs. I think that should get worked out in the private system.
How do you think that competition would regulate bad lawyers out of the market in a free market if lawyers were not licensed?
Well, you know, right now the government, you know, gives out a bar license. And of course, that's kind of like a good housekeeping seal of approval. I mean, we've approved this person. He's a good lawyer. You can trust him. He'll do you a good job. I mean, that's what a lot of people are going to take away from someone having a license. And
so you think if there wasn't a license required to practice law, you think there'd be like a private system, like, you know, underwriter's laboratory kind of thing?
Oh yeah, that would be great. I'd like to see that, especially for something like Food and Drug Administration. Let underwriter's laboratory certify the safe and effectiveness of drugs.
Yeah.
You know, and let the drug companies come beat it to their doorstep, because the public wants assurances like that. But instead, the public has the FDA, who they don't know if they can trust them or not. You know, the FDA is pretty cautious when it comes to okaying drugs and that. I think they think that if they refuse to allow a drug, you know, to come into use, and people are dying from the disease that it would cure, that's not their fault.
Well, people have died from drugs that the FDA has approved, and then they've unapproved drugs too.
Well, that's always going to happen. There's always going to be mistakes. But the thing is, there are drugs that if a drug might save 10,000 people, but it also might kill 100, they're going to be more afraid of the 100 it could kill than the 10,000 it would save, because the press would look bad on that. And so, I don't know if that's too smart. I think the consumer ought to be able to make that choice.
Yeah. So I'm looking at your law blog has a lot of good know your rights kind of information for anyone who wants to know your rights when confronted by police.
Yeah, unfortunately, that often happens. They know their rights after they've been arrested.
Yeah.
And questioned.
Yeah, I made this movie called Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. Have you seen it?
I haven't.
I'll send you a link to it. I'll send you a link to it. It's basically saying that people who, you know, the thing that I confronted or came across a lot was that people who are small government people, who are gun people, are often in favor of the war on drugs. And people who are, you know, weed smokers often hate guns and think guns are illegal and that the government should somehow make them disappear, which ironically involves using guns. So I also say that everybody who's anti-gun is actually pro-gun, because they want guns to be used to remove the guns. But in this movie,
they're pro some gun somewhere.
Yeah,
right?
Some gun somewhere. Unless they're into magical thinking and think that laws actually work without being enforced at the barrel of a gun. But I'll send you a link to that. I guess my final question is, what do you think about the future of America, of, you know, not even necessarily the country of America, but the geographic location known as America? What do you think? You know, I'm 48, you know, my dad's about to turn 91. So since I don't smoke and drink and neither does he, I might live to be 91. I often wonder what America's going to be like when I'm very, very old. What do you think life's going to be like in America in about 50 years? Do you think there's going to be more liberty or less?
Well, I think more. You know, I'm heartened by the what seems to me that younger people, and I'm talking about, you know, my kids' age, you know, they're in the 20s and early 30s, they seem to be more tuned in to liberty, libertarianism. And I think that's probably borne out. Like, you remember some of the polls in the primaries where Ron Paul's taken half of the people under 30, you know, and that sort of thing. I think young people are moving in that direction. So I hope it's not a false optimism, but we may be moving in the right direction, coming up from below, up at the top. And in my age and that, it's still pretty dismal. And, and I get kind of down about seeing that, but you know, the future may be there, but one thing that really bothers me even more is that with the economic conditions the way that they are, who knows when, you know, Greece is going to fall and then it drags down Italy and Spain and what are the pigs over there in Europe and comes tumbling into the United States. What if we have, you know, get into a real bad way between now and then? I mean, I just hope that there'll be that if that ever happens, we have some kind of chaotic, you know, collapse in our system, that there are enough freedom-minded people that, you know, when things get bad enough, we don't resort to, you know, the man on the white horse. That kind of bothers me, and so I guess that means that we all just need to keep working to see that that doesn't happen. I don't want to see any kind of violent revolution, and that would be a little incongruous for people who say, no, you're not allowed to aggress against anyone.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it happens slowly, well, maybe that would be the best. I mean, I'd like to see it tomorrow, but if we keep moving in that way, what can I say? That's great. I just hope we have time.
Excellent. I don't know. Thanks a lot, Randy. It's been a really good time talking to you. Thanks for coming on the Gumbos.
Thank you, Michael. It's been great.
Excellent.
Hey, let's talk again sometime.
Yep. Take care.
Since time began, tyrants have taken aim at personal liberties. Now there's a movie that aims back.
The government has no more right to tell us what to put in our bodies than they have to take our guns or tell us what books we can read.
Six drug police were eaten by bears while raiding a marijuana farm.
On your knees, you dirty hippies!
Jesus.
On your knees!
What's the problem, officer?
Today, many cops who enforce pot laws do so only because it provides them with cushy jobs, good benefits, and a chance to push people around.
I was an undercover narcotics officer. The drug war is nothing but a farce.
The Second Amendment says you gotta keep you and your gat intact.
Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. A film by Michael W. Dean and Nima Vadadi.
DVD available now at gunsandweed.com or on Amazon. That's gunsandweed.com. Makes the perfect gift. Remember, that's gunsandweed.com.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's kittyfeet.com. All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.